This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Hello, I'm Gabriel Gatehouse. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Thursday, the 26th of September. The United States has said it agreed details of a ceasefire plan with Israel, despite Israel's Prime Minister pledging to continue to strike Hezbollah in Lebanon with full force. What is going on in the corridors of the United Nations? We'll also join a veteran BBC Middle East correspondent on the ground in Beirut for the latest and some historical perspective on the prospects for an Israeli ground incursion into southern Lebanon. Also, President Zelensky's plan for victory against Russia. Is the White House buying it? Baroness Varsi, the first Muslim woman to serve in cabinet, resigns from the Conservative Party in the Lords. And what happened to the two dots over the Bronte's name? You're listening to The World Tonight with Gabriel Gatehouse. The Israeli military will continue to strike Hezbollah with full force until residents of northern Israel can return safely to their homes. So said Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as he landed in New York this afternoon. He'll speak at the United Nations General Assembly tomorrow, but amid talk of preparation for a ground invasion, the more important conversations will be happening behind closed doors. The United States has said that proposals for a three-week ceasefire were coordinated with Israel, despite Mr. Netanyahu's fighting talk. The White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, said a diplomatic solution was key.
The tensions need to stop. We need to get to a ceasefire. And so that is what we're trying to get to here. We're going to continue to have this discussion on getting to that 21-day ceasefire. That's continuing in New York, as you know. UNGA continues, right? Even though we're back here. And so our teams are there. They're having those discussions. They're doing these diplomatic conversations. You hear us talk about it all the time. Diplomatic resolution is key.
Well, neither Mr. Netanyahu nor Hezbollah have made a direct response to the proposal. And it's a complicated puzzle, and we'll get into the pieces of it in a minute. But first, on the ground in Lebanon, Israeli strikes have continued in the south of the country, in the east, and in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Let's go live to Beirut now and speak to Jim Muir, a veteran former BBC Middle East correspondent who's been in Lebanon on and off now since 1975. Jim, thanks for staying up and joining us. What's been going on in Beirut today?
Well, if anybody, Gabriel, had thought that this ceasefire call from the Americans and others would bring about a rapid halt of the hostilities on the ground, they're absolutely wrong, of course. It's been another day of heavy Israeli bombardments, at least. This is some hours old, this figure, 115 Israeli airstrikes. It's probably quite a bit more than that in the last few hours, with 60 people killed in Lebanon, more than 80 wounded. There again, that figure has already gone up to about 88 killed and probably 100 and something wounded. So a kind of becoming almost, sadly to say, a routine day. There have been worse days in terms of the casualties. Hezbollah, of course, firing rockets and announcing it quite openly, firing rockets throughout the day at what they describe as military targets in northern Israel. There have been some images out of Israel showing houses that have been hit, but Hezbollah is certainly saying it's targeting military bases and airfields and so on. The main standout event of the day was an attack, a very targeted one, on a building in the southern suburbs of Beirut, in which just two people were killed. But one of them seems to have been Hezbollah's man in charge of drones, Mohammed Sarour, who is being announced dead by Lebanese security sources and by the Israelis. But that hasn't actually been adopted and confirmed by Hezbollah yet, although it hasn't denied it.
Can you give us a brief picture of what's been going on in the south?
In the south, the really heavy bombardments. I mean, a friend of mine who's a major figure in the city of Tyre, which has a very big conscription, as it were, a very big area around it that is regarded as under it administratively. He said there's not a single village in the whole Qusar, as it's called, the whole area, that hasn't been hit. So very heavy damage there. And of course, the border strip, all the villages along the border have been really heavily damaged, almost as though they're already trying to make a kind of a neutral zone.
Jim, stay with us. I want to come back to you later for a bit of historical perspective. But first, let's get into the ceasefire plan. Is it on or is it off? The Americans seem to imply this evening that they'd agreed something with the Israelis, but the Israelis are giving every indication that they intend to continue their offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon. So what is going on? David Schenker was US Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs between 2019 and 2021, during which time he mediated between Lebanon and Israel on drawing up their maritime border. He's now a senior fellow at the Washington Institute think tank, and he joins us live. Mr. Schenker, thank you for being with us. There doesn't seem to be any sign that Israel believes in this ceasefire plan.
No, I think that they see themselves having the initiative on the battlefield, tremendous successes against Hezbollah in the recent 2 weeks or so, starting with the pager, the assassinations, going after Hezbollah's missiles in the south, they're degrading them. They don't see that a ceasefire, a temporary ceasefire, would achieve their goal, because Hezbollah continues to link any permanent ceasefire or negotiated solution to a formal ceasefire in Gaza.
So what do you think has gone on here? Because the Americans seem to be implying that they'd agreed something. Is this a misunderstanding?
Well, there have been misunderstandings before with Israel appearing to backtrack on previously agreed deals. But also in the intervening time, a key minister in Israel's government, coalition partner of Netanyahu, said he would bolt the coalition with his party if Israel signed on to a ceasefire agreement.
It doesn't look like the U.S. administration is having much leverage, really. I mean, if they can't bring the Israelis to agree to something that they apparently had agreed to.
Yeah, I think that there's a disagreement right now with the administration and actually within the Israeli government. Some people see the benefit of pursuing further the degradation of Hezbollah's military capabilities and don't see a negotiated solution coming down the pike that would be acceptable and allow for Israel to move the 70,000 of its citizens back to their homes. The administration can try and pressure Israel more, but it has absolutely zero leverage with Hezbollah.
Mm. It is a complicated puzzle, isn't it? Because what Hezbollah is demanding is a ceasefire in Gaza, and it seems like it'd be very difficult for Israel to agree that at the behest of Hezbollah. How do you make something like this work?
Well, that's why it's so difficult. Israel will never agree to Hezbollah's demand to link these two and to sign on to a ceasefire. By the way, it's not only the Israelis that are having a hard time agreeing to a ceasefire in Gaza. It is also Hamas, which actually sees the opportunity to broaden the conflict into a region-wide conflagration. And so they're balking as well. I don't see any solution other than Hezbollah sort of backing off this linkage. And if they don't do it, I think right now Israel has shown not only air superiority, but intelligence dominance that is having a real impact on the ground. And Hezbollah's morale is the lowest it's ever been.
Okay. Once again, a big mismatch between the diplomatic talk in New York and facts on the ground. David Schenker, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, thank you for being with us. I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Meanwhile, thousands of people have been fleeing the Israeli bombardment to neighbouring Syria. Syria itself, of course, has been at war for more than a decade, and there are perhaps over a million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. But now the flow is in the other direction. Soher Zakout is a spokesman for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Syria. She was on the Lebanese border yesterday, and she told me what she saw before we came on air.
You name it, women, children, elderly people, in cars, buses, but also walking. They are picking up what they could of their belongings, clothes or mattresses on top of their cars. Those families, they have been through a lot in the past 11 months. And now the most difficult thing, as a mother was telling me, the most difficult decision that a mother can take is to decide to flee the country to seek safety.
Of course.
This is what we saw yesterday. But today, our teams went again to the crossing to help with water bottles. The Syrian Arab Red Crescent also distributed food.
I was going to say, do they have food? Do they have shelter? Is there enough provision?
Well, so far, there was no official shelter opened for the people who are crossing.
So where are people staying? Where are people spending the night?
Inside the city.
Are the local authorities coping?
The authorities, they have things in place. We are in contact with the relevant authorities in terms of the Ministry of Health.
Syria, obviously, is a country that is still in conflict itself. Is Syria able to cope with an influx of refugees, especially if these numbers get bigger?
You are right. Syrians have been enduring a lot of the humanitarian consequences of the past 13 years. 50% of the infrastructure is partially working or not working, like the health and water infrastructure is not working properly. And any additional strain on Syria, it will be a burden for the population to deal with and to endure. But as we witness, they were observed and welcomed by the communities mm-hmm. in Syria.
Can I ask you a broader question? We've seen these suggestions that there might be a full-scale ground invasion by Israeli forces. What would be the implications of that from your standpoint as somebody who works for the ICRC,
Red Cross? Let's don't speculate.
What I mean by that question is, are you preparing for things to potentially get a lot bigger?
We are prepared, but let's not speculate. And whatever can be prevented from happening should be taken into consideration. Any step that can bring this escalation of violence to a political solution that can serve the whole population of the Middle East.
That was Soher Zakout, spokeswoman for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Syria. Let's go back to Jim Muir in Beirut. Jim, you've got a long memory. You've been there on and off, as I said at the beginning, since the start of the civil war in 1975. This talk of a ground invasion, an incursion, we've seen this before. Is it clear to you what the Israeli game plan is now?
No, it's not really, I have to say. There's a lot of talk about an incursion on the ground. I'd be very surprised, having sat down there for the whole month of the war in 2006 between Hezbollah and Israel, I'd be very surprised if they would just simply throw troops in at this stage, because they did that at the end of that month-long war and got really ambushed and lost a lot of men. So it's not something to be done lightly. Are they going to occupy a border strip? I mean, they've tried that. They were there from 1982 till 2000 when they withdrew in disarray in the middle of the night after so many Hezbollah attacks over the years. They know that it's a bog into which it's very easy to sink. So I'd be very surprised if they came marching in with bells and whistles and drums and all the rest of it. The most I would expect them to do would be perhaps targeted commando raids in and out, that kind of thing. But to put troops across there and keep them there, first of all, it would would be a target that would attract attacks for as long as they were there? And secondly, how on earth would that allow them to bring residents safely back to the north of Israel, which is the supposed war aim?
Mm-hmm. You heard David Schenker there describing how, in Israel's view, they seem to have the upper hand at the moment, or at least that's the way they're feeling. But if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is if they went in full force, that could change.
They would perhaps be levelling out the battlefield, as it were, and Hezbollah is counting on that. Nasrallah, the Hezbollah chief, last week said we'd welcome them to come in because then we can get at them. So it would, in a way, be bringing it back into Hezbollah's kind of comfort zone. What we've been seeing in the last week is an extraordinary display of technical prowess by the Israelis. The whole business of the pagers and the walkie-talkies exploding, etc., plus all these very targeted air raids, plus a lot of very damaging air raids and a lot of very heavy casualties. So, I mean, Hezbollah has been outsmarted in that sense. If the Israelis were to expose themselves on the ground, they could be really coming back into, as I say, into the kind of warfare that Hezbollah understands. Hezbollah, I think, has been kind of stuck in the mentality of 2006, whereas the Israelis have moved way ahead.
Jim Muir in Beirut, thank you very much for your long memory and your wisdom. Coming up, the mayor of New York accused of taking $100,000 in foreign bribes, but staying defiant.
My attorneys will take care of the case so I can take care of the city. My day-to-day will not change. I will continue to do the job for 8.3 million New Yorkers that I was elected to do.
We'll hear about Eric Adams and what he's alleged to have done and how much trouble he's in a little later in the programme. Now, there's been much anticipation of Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky's five-point plan for victory in his country's war with Russia. He's in Washington tonight, presenting that plan to congressional leaders and the White House. Presidents Zelensky and Biden met at the White House earlier tonight after the American president announced nearly $8 billion of aid for Ukraine. And then Mr. Zelensky and Vice President Kamala Harris spoke to the media. She pledged support for Ukraine, and there was some not so thinly veiled criticism of her Republican opponent in this year's elections.
There are some in my country who would instead force Ukraine to give up large parts of its sovereign territory, who would demand that Ukraine accept neutrality, and would require Ukraine to forego security relationships with other nations. These proposals are the same of those of Putin. And let us be clear, they are not proposals for peace.
What was missing was any detail about the five-point plan. Mr. Zelensky said he'd be sharing those details with Ms. Harris.
We have to end this war. We need a just peace, and we must protect our people. And we'll have an important meeting today, right after I'd talked to President Biden about the plan of victory, and I will share some details of the plan with Vice President Harris.
Well, in a minute, we'll be speaking to a former U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine negotiations to see if we can get some clarity on the plan and whether the Biden administration thinks it's viable. But first, here's the BBC's Jessica Parker from the Ukrainian capital Kyiv on the mood there as these vital meetings are taking place.
This White House meeting is probably the climax of a week of diplomacy for President Zelensky in the US. News that further American military aid is being sent to Ukraine will be welcomed here, as overnight, Russian missile and drone strikes continued, including here in Kyiv. This is the Pechersky district of Kyiv, and after last night's drone attack, here I can see blocks of flats with a lot of broken glass, broken windows, cars that have been pierced by shrapnel. And all across this little neighbourhood now, people are clearing up once again. 31-year-old Mariana is stood outside as they sweep the debris away, her two-month-old daughter strapped to her chest.
I woke up to the sound of the drone. I got up and saw the reflection in the windows, how a big ball of fire was falling down. A fragment flew into our window, breaking the glass. Fortunately, miraculously, it didn't hurt the child who was sleeping there.
with President Zelensky presenting what he's calling a victory plan to leaders in the West. I ask, Mariana, how important Western support is to Ukraine's hope of fending off the Russian invasion.
I believe it's not possible we achieve that on our own. We need help from any countries, absolutely. Otherwise, we will not win.
I also ask 68-year-old Natalia if she believes victory is possible for Ukraine.
I don't know, but my close friend is fighting, and several more friends are fighting. Of course, they know better at the front, but they are not in the mood to surrender. They are fighting and not going to leave, run away from the front line or demobilize.
Despite the resilience of Ukrainians, there's a general recognition they need Western support, which depends not just on President Biden as he prepares to leave office, but also whoever comes next. A meeting between President Zelensky and Republican nominee Donald Trump, who's again hinted this week he could curtail support to Kyiv, now appears to be off, while some Republicans have criticized the Zelensky camp for what they see as partisan behavior, with just over a month to go before the US election.
Jessica Parker reporting from Kyiv. Well, Kurt Volker is a former US ambassador to NATO, a former US special representative for Ukraine negotiations. He's currently a distinguished fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. I spoke to him shortly before we came on air. What does he understand is in President Zelensky's plan for victory?
I think the whole purpose of this plan is to address the critique from the United States that says, you don't need these long-range capabilities, or why should we approve these long-range targeting on your side? The Russians have already moved their aircraft. What difference will it make? What's your plan? How is this going to matter? So I think the Ukrainians felt obliged to come back with a plan and say, it does matter. We do need this. Here's how this all fits together. Now, what is it? I think it is the ability to attack Russian fuel depots, ammunition depots, bridges, road and rail lines that provide logistical support for things coming into Ukraine.
Inside Russia.
Both inside Ukraine, where they can't reach without the long-range authorizations, as well as inside Russia. And this would disrupt Russia's war effort.
So it's a plea for these long-range missiles. Do you have any sense of whether the plan looks convincing to the White House?
I think plan is going to sound a little bit exaggerated compared to what the argument really is.
So it's a plea.
Yeah, it's a plea. Help us do these things, and these things will make a difference. And in addition to that, there's an economic component. We got to get our economy going properly. There's a diplomatic component. We're ready to have talks, but we've got to be in a position of strength. And there's an institutional component. At the end of the war, we have to be in NATO, because that's the only way you deter Putin in the future. Mm-hmm. We don't have a strategy for Ukraine winning.
What do you mean?
We have a strategy for preventing Ukraine from losing.
Right.
If they wanted that, they would be rolling up their sleeves and sitting down with the Ukrainians and saying, okay, how do we win? What do we do? That's not happening.
Why do you think they don't want it?
It's the fear of World War III, the fear of escalation, right, that Putin would view this as a U.S. war against Russia and retaliate by expanding it to U.S. allies or to the United States itself or nuclear weapons.
President Putin has explicitly said that he was going to change Russia's nuclear doctrine to consider a concerted attack by a non-nuclear state, brackets Ukraine, right, that was supported by a nuclear state as a joint attack.
Exactly, because he knows that that kind of rhetoric works. It is saying things in order to provoke a certain response from the U.S. and the West, which is to back down or back away. I don't think it has anything to do with whether he would really use nuclear weapons or not.
There's a sense, isn't there, from the Ukrainians, from President Zelensky, that they may be months away from a whole different ballgame, a different administration, a Trump administration potentially, that would be much harder on them and trying to force them to the negotiating table with Moscow.
Yes, I think they are very worried about what a Trump administration's policies might be. But I think the best way for the Ukrainians to handle that is to have their own strategy, which again is, you know, comes back to the
plan,
the message they're bringing to Biden and what they're offering to brief to Trump as well. Say, here's how we view this, here's what we're trying to do.
Some Republicans have been infuriated by the fact that President Zelensky visited an arms factory in Scranton, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. with senior Democrats and no Republicans present. Donald Trump, it seems, won't be meeting President Zelensky here. Has President Zelensky made a bit of a political blunder here, walking into the United States just weeks before a presidential election and seemingly not dealing with it very astutely?
Yes, without question, this was a big mistake. Any other time, other than a presidential election, any other time, going to visit a weapons factory in the United States and saying thank you to the people who are making these munitions that are vital to Ukraine's fight for freedom, that would be a good thing to do. But 6 weeks before a presidential election in what is a critical swing state and doing it only with Democrats is doing exactly the wrong thing. It is making Ukraine a political issue in our election when that's the last thing Ukraine should want.
It seems like both sides want to make Ukraine a political issue in the election. We just saw Vice President Harris come out in her joint statement with President Zelensky saying there are some in my country who would force Ukraine mm-hmm. to give up large parts of its sovereign territory. These proposals are the same as those of Putin. They are proposals for surrender, which is dangerous. I mean, President Zelensky's become a political football.
He has. And Ukraine has been for years. I mean, remember the whole Trump impeachment thing 5 years ago in 2019. Mm-hmm. It was all about Ukraine and the Hunter Biden things. You know, again, all about Ukraine. So this is a curse that seems to stalk Ukraine, is to always be in the center of U.S. domestic politics. And it's the last thing they should want.
That was Kurt Volker. And we've just got some news dropping that from Reuters here. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump said on Thursday he will meet Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky on Friday in New York. That meeting's going to be in the morning, 9:45 at Trump Tower. The main headlines so far on The World Tonight. American negotiators say they coordinated a proposal for a 3-week ceasefire in Lebanon with Israel, despite Benjamin Netanyahu's apparent rejection of the idea. Sir Keir Starmer is preparing for his first meeting with the former US President Donald Trump in New York, where he'll address the UN General Assembly. And the government is reconsidering plans to end concessions for residents who register to pay tax abroad amid concerns that they won't raise enough money. Baroness Saidavasi has resigned from the Conservative Party in the House of Lords, saying the party has moved to the far right. She's not just the first Muslim woman to serve as a UK cabinet minister, she's a former co-chair of the Tories, and her announcement comes as the party prepares for a party conference in the middle of a leadership election. The BBC's political correspondent Damian Grammaticus joins me now from Westminster. Damian, first of all, what exactly did Baroness Varsi say in her statement?
Yeah, so this was put out on X, formerly Twitter, took everyone a little bit by surprise. She said that she announced this resignation, saying it was with a heavy heart. She could no longer take the Conservative whip. She did say, she said, I'm a Conservative and remain so, but the current party are far removed from the party that she joined and served in the cabinet. That was in David Cameron's time. She said it was a reflection of how far right the party had moved and what she called hypocrisy and double standards in its treatment of different communities.
And what has the Conservative Party said?
Well, they came out in response to that, saying that they had actually informed Baroness Varsi that an investigation was going to be held into it earlier this week. And that was in response to complaints, they said, regarding divisive language allegedly used by her. And they said they had a responsibility to investigate all complaints that they received.
Right. And that those divisive comments centered on a court case, right? Can you just dig into that a bit?
Yes, that's right. So behind all of this, what wasn't clear in those but became clear pretty quickly was that there was a court case. This takes us back to those pro-Palestinian demonstrations in recent months. A 37-year-old teacher, Mariejo Hussein, had been at a protest. She had a placard showing a coconut tree, a pile of coconuts underneath it, and photos of Rishi Sunak and Suella Braverman superimposed on that. Now, she was prosecuted for an aggravated racial offence. That prosecution was failed. She was acquitted like 2 weeks ago or so. Now, her barrister at the time had said that basically this was an attack on free speech, that this was someone exercising their free right to criticise a person maybe of their own racial background, but alleging that they were racist themselves and that this should never have been brought. And she was very strong in her criticism of that case. Now, Baroness Varsi had then tweeted support for Maria Hossein following her acquittal.
Damien Grammaticus in Westminster, thank you very much. Now, prosecutors in the United States have accused the mayor of New York, Eric Adams, of taking $100,000 in foreign bribes. He's facing five criminal charges, including wire fraud and soliciting illegal campaign contributions. It's the first time a sitting mayor of the city has been charged with a crime. Speaking at a news conference, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, Damien Williams, said Mr. Adams had broken the trust of the people.
The conduct alleged in the indictment, the foreign money, the corporate money, the bribery, the years of concealment, is a grave breach of the public's trust. Public office is a privilege. We allege that Mayor Adams abused that privilege and broke the law. Laws that are designed to ensure that officials like him serve the people, not the highest bidder, not a foreign bidder, and certainly not a foreign power. These are bright red lines, and we allege that the mayor crossed them again and again for years.
Well, Mr. Adams has called the allegations against him lies, and in a brief news conference of his own, he said he wasn't going anywhere.
This is not surprising to us at all. And I ask New Yorkers to wait to hear our defense before making any judgments. You're going to hear a story. The story will come from the federal prosecutors. And I ask to wait and hear our side to this narrative. From here, my attorneys will take care of the case so I can take care of the city. My day-to-day will not change. I will continue to do the job for 8.3 million New Yorkers that I was elected to do.
Eric Adams, the embattled mayor of New York. Well, I've been speaking to Craig McCarthy, the City Hall Bureau Chief for the New York Post, and he told me more about these allegations.
So the prosecutors in this case are saying Mayor Eric Adams has taken multiple gifts from foreign countries without reporting them to the public. And in New York City, you're required to disclose any valuable gifts. They are coming from Turkish Airlines. There's also multiple trips to other countries. One of the ones that is talking about in Turkey, where he stayed in the Bentley suite of this hotel that went for thousands of dollars, and he only ended up paying a few hundred dollars a night for the room. The attorney's office, they allege that the reason why he took these gifts is to, for a favor in some sort of sense, whether that was to be to talk down some talking point of, for the, that the Turkish government wanted, or in another case for the Turkish consulate, in which they were asking Adams to help fast track the fire safety of the consulate, which fire officials who were inspecting it had raised significant concerns about the safety of the building.
And then there was a campaign finance aspect to this as well, right?
The campaign finance comes in with the straw donors, which is an alleged plot to package these donors together so you can kind of hide the identity of who's actually funneling this money in, which sometimes the people whose names are put down on the donations, since there are matched donations, they don't even know that their names are attributed to these. And then they can basically launder the money through that scheme.
And what has Eric Adams said in response to all of this?
He said he's not going to step down. He said he's going to continue leading New York City because that is what the people of New York elected him to do.
And is he likely to be able to do that, or can someone remove him?
And that's going to be the burning question. This is something that is in the state charter to remove him. The governor can step in if she has cause and he has been charged. And there could also be a committee that is formed on the city level that could work together to remove him. But I have to stress, however, this has never been done before. So there's going to be legal hiccups along the way. This is the first time a mayor that has been elected and is still in his office has been charged with a crime.
Is he a popular figure in New York?
Currently, he is not. He started off very popular. He started off running on a platform to reduce crime and to bring New York City back. We were coming out of the pandemic here in New York City. There was a rise in shootings, a rise in murders. Businesses were down. People were not, their tourism was down. No one was riding the subways. And he came in, he tried to right the ship. He tried to bring business back. And business has been coming back. But besides shooting and murders, a lot of crimes have not gone down. And that has been a real struggle for his administration, leading to recently, the last poll that came out was historic low approval rating.
Now, he's a Democrat, right?
Yes.
And yet he claims that he's being scapegoated by the Biden government. What's going on there?
His rationale and what his supporters have said for months now is that he is being the scapegoat for being a very vocal critic of the Biden administration in a period that we here in New York City are dealing with an unprecedented wave of asylum seekers who are coming up from the southern border. And the New York City officials are on the hook financially to house them because of certain local laws that require anybody who is homeless, who needs housing and wants housing, to be given it.
That was Craig McCarthy, the City Hall bureau chief for the New York Post. And now, as promised, to the Brontes.
After meeting with the stranger on the road, I do not like re-entering Thornfield. To pass its threshold is to return to stagnation. The hall is dark, not yet lit.
As an extract from the BBC radio adaptation of the literary classic Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. And for nearly 100 years, there's been a plaque in Poets Corner commemorating Charlotte and the other Bronte sisters, Emily and Anne, in Westminster Abbey. But something wasn't right. Their surname was misspelt. It was missing the diaceses, otherwise known as those two little dots on the final E of the Bronte. And here's the weird thing. For 85 years, no one mentioned it. Well, the error has been spotted. It was spotted by Sharon Wright, the editor of the Bronte Society Gazette, and it's now been corrected. But what took them so long? I'm joined by Bronte expert and enthusiast Graham Watson. He's also the author of the book The Invention of Charlotte Bronte. Thanks for joining us, Graham. First of all, am I pronouncing this thing correct? Is it diaceses?
It's diaceses or diaresis. Even this is in debate, just like the Bronte surname.
Okay, I was going to say umlaut, but maybe that's too German.
Well, we can go with that as simple as well.
Okay, well, so just tell me, first of all, where do they come from? What do they mean?
Well, this accent on the final E creates a new syllable in the name. The Bronte surname, it's usually attributed to Patrick Bronte, the curate father of the three Bronte sisters, who came from Ireland. It was when he came to St. John's College, Cambridge, in October 1802, that his name was recorded phonetically from Brante, B-R-A-N-T-Y, to Bronte, without the diaceses. But then he started to use an accent over the surname. We can see in his marriage certificate, he uses a tilde, otherwise known as a wavy line, over the last E. But most importantly, his three daughters, Charlotte, Emily and Anne, always used that diaceses over the final syllable. So what's the significance of this? Well, it sets the record straight, essentially. And it is a historical record, so it's important that it has now been corrected.
These two dots that Patrick sort of allowed to stay over his name when it was misspelt, was that a class thing? Was that a moving from Ireland thing? What was going on?
Well,
there?
Possibly. Yes, possibly. Because at the same time that Patrick allowed this mistake to pass, there was a Duke of Bronte. So Bronte obviously is a place in Sicily, and we can tell that Charlotte essentially knew of the connection because she sometimes spelled her name, well, she wrote her name as Charlotte Thunder, Bronte being an alternate word for thunder in Greek. So we know that she knew of that connection, but there is a suggestion that there's a sort of class elevation by using that diaceses. There was certainly no one else in England with that surname at the time.
What do you make of the fact that for 85 years, no one seems to have noticed this omission in Westminster Abbey?
I think this is either a celebration or admission of British politeness. I think no one's had the nerve to say anything. It's great that Sharon Wright has finally set the record straight and shows that it can be done even after all this time.
Far too awkward to mention it. Don't mention the two dots. We're too British. Graham Watson, author of the book The Invention of Charlotte Bronte, thank you very much for joining us. Just time for our closing headlines. American negotiators say they coordinated a proposal for a three-week ceasefire in Lebanon with Israel, despite Benjamin Netanyahu's apparent rejection of the idea. In his first address to the United Nations General Assembly, Sir Keir Starmer called on Israel and Hezbollah to step back from the brink. He said there needed to be an immediate ceasefire both in Lebanon and in Gaza. And that's The World Tonight. This is Gabriel Gatehouse. I'll be back tomorrow. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Thank you, Gabriel. Studio direction was by Sarah Kimberley and the editor was Martin Venard.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.